I've seen a lot of change, been through a lot of pain. Some things are not the same as they were a year ago, but all will be okay. I move on each and every day. The past is where it stays, way back a year ago.
Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to your favorite podcast, the Wake and Make podcast. I'm super excited. We got a good friend of mine. This is a very anticipated podcast and guest for me, somebody that I've been trying to get on my previous podcast, now this podcast. So I'm trying to fit in the word podcast as much as I can in this intro. So we have Justin Bondi of Royal Peak Goods out of Canada, a good friend of mine, a good friend of yours, and I'm really excited to sit down and chat, hear Justin's story, and there's a lot of parallels between him and I, so this is going to be a really, really cool conversation. I'm excited. So welcome, Justin. Thank you for being a part of the podcast today.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much for having me. Super stoked to get on.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you mind telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get right into it, man?
Yeah, for sure. So again, Justin from Canada, started Royal Peak Goods in 2019. Started off as a hobby, you know, making a wallet or two. And some friends were asking to buy wallets, and some friends like, hey, can you make me a belt? I was like, sure, let's give it a go. So I started that. More just about me, myself. I'm just a husband, a father, a dog dad. This is my side hustle, kind of side hobby business that I love doing. I guess, you know, it's easy to say, but good Canadian boy, a hockey guy in Canada.
Doing my thing. I've always been intrigued by our neighbors up north, and I feel that there's so many similarities between us down south and you guys up north. I've made a lot of friends through Leathercraft with Canadians, and I just want to make a trip up there to come spend some time with you guys. That would be so stinking rad. I love it. I think that every Canadian that I've met has just been the kindest person I've ever met, and I don't know, I want to eat some real poutine and you know, drink some maple syrup, so I want to come visit soon.
Yeah, man, love to have you up anytime.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to get right into something that's a little maybe taboo or even a little hard to talk about, but you and I have many similarities, a lot of parallels. In the time that we've talked, I found out that, like I said, we're very similar. One of the things is that we share the why of why we got into Leathercraft, and that being that it's helped us with mental health issues. And I know I'm very outspoken and incredibly honest about my struggles with mental health that are ongoing on a daily basis. And the time that I've spent talking about it, I realized that there is a massive amount of people within our community as a whole that use Leathercraft as an outlet and a therapy for their mental health. And when I speak to different companies, I always bring that up and, you know, reach out to see what we can do to help people that are struggling with mental health within our community. And that's something that I'm super passionate about. What was it about Leathercraft that helped you? And maybe you can give us a little bit of background, as comfortable as you are to speak about it, Justin.
Yeah, for sure. So it's like the Leathercrafting itself was a hobby in like 2016, 2017. And it was just a fun thing I did. You know, me and my wife, we'd been married a couple of years at that point and no kids or nothing yet. And we got our house, just a hobby, something to do. And then 2019, so we were expecting our daughter this year. And come April, she was born. And it wasn't sort of the start you'd imagine when getting ready for a new baby. She came 2 months early. So she was automatically admitted into the neonatal intensive care unit up here in Hamilton at the McMaster Children's Hospital, where she spent the next 376 days.
Wow.
It was a,
I'm so sorry, man. I'm so, I, there's that's not parallel, and there's nothing I can say to even like, I'm just sorry, man.
No, I mean we're a small bunch that have kind of been through something like that long. But you know, we learned a lot from that time and went through an insane amount of stuff. So for me, come April 15th, 2020, when she was finally coming home from the hospital, you know, we were 1 month or so into the pandemic, and my day job, I have about an hour drive to and from, which is with my family. So I was fortunate to be able to have some flexibility there. So I was going to be home for a while, saving that time driving, just doing dad duties. And that's when, you know, a lot of the stuff we went through in the hospital was starting to kind of sink in and hit home a lot. So I found with my leather craft, where it wasn't Royal Peak or nothing yet, it was just still me making stuff. And I found that just coming into the garage, at that time I was in the basement, and just cutting leather, stitching leather, you know, having a cup of coffee or beer with it, whatever. It was just sort of mentally freeing. And I was able to not think about that stuff, but just calm. It's very calming. And that's,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The monotonous, I don't know if monotonous is the right word, but the repetitive motions of, like you said, cutting leather, stitching leather, doing the things that may seem a little bit boring to us at times now are the things that are so relieving, because you have to stay focused. You have to know what you're doing, but it's also repetitive. And I can completely relate to what it is that you're saying in the movement of what it is that we do and how much that really kind of plays into clearing your mind. And that's something that I hear regularly from people that struggle with mental health. And it doesn't even have to be mental health, because sometimes it's just sadness or being anxious about something. Your mind's racing, and it's not that you're diagnosed with anything, but it's that you're having a shit day. So you want to really kind of like focus on something else. Oh. And it can take you out of your bummer mindset.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and there's a cool thing that I love about it is when you first kind of like, it sounds cheesy, but you know, it is what it is when you unroll that piece of leather, and then an hour and a half later, it's this, you know, in my mind, a piece of art that I've created that, you know, is likely going to be, you know, someone might have purchased, and maybe they're gifting it to their husband or whatever it may be. And it's just, it's a cool feeling to have that process and giving it to someone.
It never goes away, man. No. And you're a lot faster than me, man. I can't make anything in an hour and a half. I'm still cutting them.
You're the tooling and stuff. That's way out of my realm.
It's just that too is so relatable. When you sit down, like you said, unroll a big old chunk of leather that's nothing. I mean, it is something. It's tangible, but then you're able to transform that into something that people are going to use for the rest of their life, and they're going to hand down, in hopes, if it doesn't get lost, to the next generation. Like I always say, like our products are multi-generational products. It's not fast fashion. And knowing that something, like you said, that you make with your hands is going to be in someone else's hands, like for the rest of their life, like the thing I made with these are going to be with something else, someone else. Like, that's so cool to me.
I had one in particular. I remember it was someone bought it for their son who was just getting his G1, his learner's permit, driver's license. And he had just got it, and it came in the mail, and he didn't know, like, he didn't obviously see it yet. So she bought him a wallet and put his driver's license in there to gift it to him as like when he first got his license. So it's kind of a cool thing.
That's something unique to what it is that we do, is those kinds of stories and being able to be a part of it and hearing the behind the scenes kind of thing, where if we were massive, massive companies and a mom bought their kid a wallet from Macy's or JCPenney's or anything equivalent to that in Canada or wherever you're listening to this, basically a cheap department store. The CEO of that company doesn't get to hear these stories. And to me, that is some of the most rewarding thing on par with the making with your hands and giving it to someone is the stories, hearing how much it means to people and working hands-on with that person. It's, man, that's what makes it all worth it to me.
Yeah. And I've done some wedding parties and stuff too. And all the guys' initials are in it, and it's a memory of that day for them and stuff. And a lot of the time I actually try and film little clips of making those things to send to them as well. So, and whether they care or not, I don't know, but I think it's cool. So
it's funny you say that, because I think people care more than we probably expect. I've spoken to quite a few people, doing the short format vertical videos for Reels or TikTok and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of people find us through that. A lot of people find me through that. I can only speak for myself, but a lot of people will request that, hey man, can you make a video out of this one? And I'm like, I either say yes or no. I'm very blunt when it comes to that. Not every single one fits with my brand, and I probably wouldn't even take photos because I don't want to duplicate that over and over and over again. But yeah, man, it's so cool. If not, I speak about this quite a bit on the podcast too, is taking photos, progress photos, and putting it in your stories and mentioning the person that it's for. It makes them feel special. You can easily take yourself out of your situation and put it in theirs and be like, whoa, I ordered this, whatever it is that's handmade, and they're tagging me in it, and they have X amount of followers. Other people are seeing the project that I'm getting made. It creates another layer of customer service that I think is so cool.
Totally, yeah. I'm more kind of bound to the brand and the product, and it's cool, definitely.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. Speaking of branding and the importance of branding, your branding is so good and it means so much to you. Can you elaborate a little bit on what Royal Peak is and what it means to you?
Yeah, for sure. So it's when I was trying to come up with a name, coming up with a name and a logo is surprisingly difficult. I mean, that's not what I do, so maybe it would be easier if that's what I went to school for or something. But it took me forever to make a list of names, come up with stuff. And I'd create a logo. I'm like, boom, that's a banger. That's it. And I'd show it to people nah. I'm like, well, start over. But then when it came down to the name, so the city I'm in, Guelph, it's nicknamed the Royal City. And where we are in the city, the street behind us is City View. So it's the highest point of the city.
Yeah. So
Royal Peak is what that came from. And it's kind of a cheesy aspect of it, but you can see I got skateboard brands and stuff here. When I was a kid,
yeah.
I was a big snowboarder, and I always had this vision of having a snowboard brand, and I would draw the logo in elementary school, thinking it was so cool. And it was Peak Industries. So
yeah,
kind of get to go full circle and kind of make it a thing. But as far as the branding, the logo itself. So my wife and I love Western Canada. We love, went out there a bunch in the mountains, and like I said, I was a snowboarder and stuff. And so I wanted to incorporate that in there somehow, given the name. And also family's the number one thing in the world to me. So the four peaks is to represent myself, my wife, my daughter, and my dog, of course. So that was, it's just sort of a, and the logo came super naturally, organically. I spent, like I said, I spent weeks, months trying to figure out something. Then I asked a buddy who, is in this sort of, and he's like, yeah, I'll get a guy to make something for you. And it just came this time, that's the one.
Yeah, no, I love your, we were talking briefly a little bit before this and how I think you may or may not relate to this, but when I am looking at other makers' products, I no longer look at their products as much as I do their marketing, their advertising, their branding, their logo, all of the things. I look at it more as a business owner looking at another business owner rather than the products that they make. It's just the way where my brain is now. And coming across your logo, your branding, how you incorporate it is something that sparks my interest. I love it. I love it that you actually incorporate it into the cuts of your products at this point. I think that's just, I don't know. It's just cool. It's cool to me. And I can relate to what you were saying about, I grew up skateboarding, snowboarding as well. Obviously, snowboarding in Southern California. I mean, we have some pretty decent famous mountains and Big Bear and stuff like that, but not the same as Canada. But I did the same thing, just copying skateboarding logos. And that was like influential in my early life becoming an artist, just duplicating other people. And I could totally see your logo really kind of spanning so many different genres of apparel, whether it's like outdoorsy kind of outdoorsy lifestyle, or like, I don't know, streetwear, like anything like that, a skateboard company, like any of that kind of stuff. And just the Four Peaks on itself, without even the name of your brand, stands well as a logo and it's identifiable.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's like you said, I'm also big into that whole aspect of not just looking at the product itself. It's the whole package. You know, it's got to have good folks behind it, and it's, you know, it's much more of much more appealing to me when that's the case. You know. And especially like, you know, in our little leather craft community, when you get to like actually know the people, not just, you know, like you chat daily with some people, and it's an important thing to me too, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you say that. And we do get to know each other so much on a completely different level than like, I don't know how to explain it to people. And I think the majority of the people that listen to this podcast are a part of the bigger community, whether they're, you know, leathersmiths, if they're woodworkers, if they're blacksmiths, whatever it is. I can't emphasize enough to get tied in with people within your community, even if it's a handful, 3 or 4 people that you kind of check in with regularly. And this even like doubles back to like the mental health thing. Like there's times that I go a little bit like MIA for a couple of weeks because I'm busy either with this podcast or working on a project or whatever. And people will reach out like, hey man, just checking up on you. Haven't heard from you in a couple of weeks. How you doing? You know, it's important, man. And that makes you feel like you're valuable to somebody that's your peer. If you want to look at it, it's your competition, which I don't think in leathercraft it's kind of looked down upon. If you consider your peers competition, like the market's big enough. If you're not succeeding in what we're doing, it's not the other guy's fault. It's your fault. Like you need to step up different aspects of your business.
For sure.
So, but yeah, I wanted to touch bases too. I know that you're really active in charity work. And I think this kind of goes back to your daughter and that kind of that situation. Can you speak a little bit on what you do to give back to the world, and specifically the organization that you work with?
Yeah, for sure. So it does definitely goes back to, you know, my time spent in the hospital with my little one. But so 10% of all our sales we give to McMaster Children's Hospital. So at the end of the year, like last year, we just tallied up our sales for the year and then just called them up and gave them $1,000. Going previous to that, my day job, I annually ran a golf tournament, and it was various charities. But once my daughter was born and we went through that, we switched it to that charity and we raised $10,000, and we did that there. So I continuously, everything we sell, 10% goes there. I got a couple other things coming up. I'm trying to do, I was going to try and do it earlier in the month, but time gets away. We also spent time at, I don't know, I think they have in the US, Ronald McDonald House.
Yeah.
So we spent a lot of time there as well. So, and it's just, when we're there, you seeing the amount of donations and care and love that gets put into those places. And like, once you need it, it's like, it was overwhelming to us to see the love kind of going on there. So I'm trying to plan something where we sponsor a couple dinners at the Ronald McDonald House, and maybe do some prizes or giveaways or something for the families that are there. Cause you know, we've been there. It's tough. It's not easy, you know, 20 hours in the hospital and 4 hours sleeping and then over. So it's just a little something to try and brighten someone's day in any way we can. So that's a really important aspect of the business for us.
Justin, I think that you're a good man for that. Aside from that, but definitely for that as well. And, you know, we speak about what we can do for our surroundings, our local communities. It doesn't have to be super big picture thing, but those, I mean, working with the hospital, Ronald McDonald House, all of those things, that's huge deals. And I think it's so cool. What I think people need to know is that it's not only beneficial for those organizations, whether it's the hospital, Ronald McDonald House, but it's good for the person. It's good for Justin. It's good for you doing that, because I think that there's something really important that happens when you give back. Like, it's really rewarding. It boosts your spirits. It really kind of, in my case, it really inspires me to work harder. And it's weird how the universe has a way of giving you twice as much, 10 times as much when you give to other people. It's shocking how that works out.
It's like you said, it is kind of therapeutic, the feeling that, you know, like in my case, I know what those people are going through. I've been there. So being able to try and brighten their day, like when I was there, someone tried to brighten our day. It's kind of a passing along thing. And just, it's therapeutic, like you said, it kind of to do that as well.
Yeah. It lifts your spirits and it creates, I'm sure for you and your family, there were people that helped you along the way. And I think that that's what we need. And not to get too deep into like the crisis us humans are going through right now, and just the hate we might encounter on a daily basis. But when you're the person that's giving back and showing love, the universe, God, Buddha, whatever you believe in, tends to give back in some way, shape, or form 10 times more. And especially when you don't go into it with the mindset of what am I going to get out of this? Like, if you just do it from the purity of your heart. And I speak for myself in this case, because I deal with a lot of childhood trauma, a lot of depression, a lot of things that are a real bummer. And something that's always helped me and always pulled me out of those kind of situations is doing something nice for other people. It just does. Totally. doing something nice for someone else, it really helps a lot.
100%. Yeah, like, there's no, you know, I definitely just do it just because we love to help people. And it has its challenges. Like, one of my challenges that I deal with from our time there is, like I said, spending 20 hours sitting in the neonatal intensive care unit, you hear a lot of sounds, you see a lot of stuff. So one of my battles that I deal with now is like it's a PTSD stuff that it's just things trigger it, even things as little as a smell that brings me back to a time there. And doing those charities, you know, we go there for appointments anyways, but you know, I'm in there and we're doing something and it's just a code pink goes off.
Yeah.
And I immediately have like a panic attack and my wife's trying to like calm me down. And it's just it's tough, but I'm there for the appointment and I'm also there because I'm trying to like maybe orchestrate some little charity thing. And it's just, that kind of brings you, like, centers me to just, let's help these people and do what we got to do.
It's so crazy that you say that, like that you specifically say like the smells or the sounds. Like, as humans, we correlate other senses to traumatic situations. And it's funny that you say that, because hospitals tend to have a unique smell, and you smell like it can trigger something so easily, or a sound, a buzzer, or anything 100%. Like that. Growing up, my mom was always in and out of the hospital. She had a lot of issues. And
sorry, we share that as well, actually. We share that in common as well. My mom was in and out of the hospital my whole childhood.
It's really, really crappy. So I always had like a huge disdain for going or being in the hospital, even like, going to support my fiance at the time when something happened, and not her in particular. And I don't want to go into the details because it's family business and stuff like that. But it makes me, like you said, so anxious to be in there, and I can't sit still, and I'm like pacing up and down the hallways, and I can't like focus on being the supportive partner that she needs, because I'm just like, man, you don't know what it was like spending, like you said, 20 hours. Like I, you know, spending the night multiple times with my mom in a hospital, not knowing if she's going to make it through. Like that creates, it's hard, man. It's really hard to be in that situation. And I don't think anyone envies your situation, obviously because of your daughter, but just spending that much time around sickness and pain has to bring it's impossible for it not to bring you down. Like I don't understand how nurses and doctors become callous to that, even though they're there to help people, which is awesome, but man, that's a tough situation, and there's going to be PTSD for a while because of that. Yeah. That's a bummer, man.
Trying to talk, you know, then gone through therapy and all other sorts of things, but bringing it back to, you know, this, it's,
yeah,
making a wall. It's kind of the only thing that's kind of been able to calm me down essentially in those times. Right. It's just,
yeah. It's so human that you say, like, you know, just having something that takes your mind out of it is, it's so good, man. I think that that's rad. And it says a lot about your character and how you're able to, just like I said, like the doctors and nurses, you're there to help people, help your daughter, help the people that are active within the hospital and give back. And man, that you're a hero to a lot of people, Justin. I think that's so cool.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah. I don't really look at it that way. Just kind of look at it as just trying to pay for it, trying to help any way you can. You know what I mean?
I think that's so rad. Well, we're going to pause really quick for an ad break. Then I want to touch bases with you. You've recently really been pushing into a YouTube channel. I want to discuss, as we do pretty much every podcast, social media. We're all makers. We're all trying to sell our products. It's 2022. So we're going to get into social media and how it affects our, you know, our business as well as our self-image and comparing ourselves to others, as well as I want to hear what I'm trying to do the same thing with this podcast and putting it on YouTube. So I would love to hear strategies, things that have worked for you, things that haven't worked for you. So when we get back from the break, we're going to catch up with Justin on his new YouTube channel. We'll be right back, guys. All right, guys, welcome back from break. We have Justin in today from Royal Peak Goods, not Leather Goods. Super stoked to have you. Like promised before we left for break, I mentioned we were going to discuss the ups and downs of starting a YouTube channel, the things that we've learned, the mistakes that we've made, the things that have been successful. And I would love to hear from you, Justin. What has it been like? When did you start your YouTube channel? What's the growth that you've seen? The growing pains that you're going through?
Well, I mean, I guess it started about a month ago, and it all started from, I wanted to do it in the beginning, even though like when I got in leather, I took pictures with my phone. I had no idea about any of it. So that's all, you know, as you know, that's all part of learning leathercraft too, is photography and video. And then a friend of mine sent me a post, and it was of a video content creator who's starting his own business, and he was, you know, interested in local brands. So I hit him up. He messaged me back. He said, "Hey man, I'd love to make you a video, you know, of your brand, like a little promo video." I'm like, "Cool, sure." You know, cause he just kind of built his profile, and there's no way I can't afford to pay for someone to do that. So I made him a wall and a belt, and he was stoked on it. So we did that, and I was like, okay, boom, here's my first video. Here's my, that started. So as we had that, I'd already had my, my camera. I've already have all that stuff. It's like, okay, well, I don't want to start the YouTube channel and then just not post anything for like a month, which is exactly what I've done. But it turns out there's a lot more into it. You see all these videos and it's like, they make it look so easy.
That's how you know someone is good at anything, is if they make it look easy. That's what we're supposed to, like, I like to read a lot, and there's a book called The 48 Laws of Power. And It's a controversial book. A lot of people think that it's a Bible to manipulation. And but one of the things is, whatever you do, make it look like it's easy. And that's something that's the hardest part, is making things look easy. But there is so much that goes into making a YouTube video. Like I've made 6 for my main channel. Now I'm up to 6 on the podcast. Podcast is quite a bit different, but to gain traction, you think that these people that are the leaders in even the leather community, the Parker or the Ryan or the, you know, Odin, all of these people that we've probably all watched so many of their videos that it just happened overnight for them. It didn't. And we need to remind ourselves that, like, it takes time, man. It takes so much time. And there's so much. It's not just making a product. It's filming it with good angles, good lighting. If you're going to do voiceover, if you're going to do an instruction video, like, how you present it, it's so tricky. And the hardest part, and I want to hear what your opinion is on this, Justin, is the waiting process, the posting something, and we're used to immediate gratification through Instagram or TikTok, where you start seeing numbers just like pinging, like, oh, I got 100 likes, and then maybe 4, 5, 10, maybe 30 people watch your YouTube video that you spent a whole day or two filming, a whole day or two editing, like, and you're like, I always break it down to time per view, and I'm like, that took me 3 hours to make per person that watched it. Like, where's the payoff? Like, it's so hard. Have you experienced that, where the frustration of that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, like, when I posted my video, I in the past month, I recently had like a reel on Instagram explode and my following skyrocketed. So when I put my first YouTube video up, I think I had like 1,000 followers. So I'm like, okay, if I share this, you know, 1,000 people might see this, maybe a quarter of them will go check it out. And, you know, that's not the case, but you're totally right. You know, you as soon as you post something on the gram, it's within minutes, 50 people like it, 12 comments, and you share whatever. And then YouTube can't, it's a totally different beast, I'm finding, to get used to. Right. But like, when I started it, the most common advice tip I got from people, when I asked Ryan, I asked Little King, several other people, you know, what do you recommend I do? Like, what's the best thing to get started? Like, just do it. Like, don't wait, just do it. The first video, like, after you make 20 videos, you're gonna look back at your first video and be like, wow, that's a piece of crap. But that's part of the curve. Yeah, that's part of learning, right? No one starts off a pro or a master. So it's totally, it's the waiting game on.
It's hard. And I think when you already have a following on other platforms, it almost makes it worse, because you're used to you're used to already having the traction somewhere that you've built up, and you've mentally prepared yourself starting an Instagram. You know, you're not going to see a lot of growth unless nowadays there are opportunities to grow a little bit faster with a reel that takes off, which no one could plan it, or we would all be doing it. We try to repurpose or redo the same video that got all of the traction. Who knows how that works out? But I think for me, it's I'll use this podcast as a perfect example, is just like you, I don't have a massive following on Instagram, but it's a really connected following. Like, I've really like instilled a lot of time into building connections with people. And so when I started the podcast, I thought that, like you said, at least a quarter of the people are going to transfer over to the podcast or whatever. They're going to be interested in this. That's not how it works. You're starting from scratch all over. And if you have to remind yourself to be just as patient as you were when starting on a new platform, when you didn't even know the craft, you were just taking photos, hoping that a couple of your friends and family would see it, and still have that passion and knowing the time frame that it takes to make it happen.
100%. And it can be draining on you. Like, when you first start off and you post something and a bunch of people like it, you get a bunch of sales from it because it's your family and friends or whatever. And then you move on a year in and you post this video and no one sees it, there are like four people watch it. It's like, oh, it's in trying to get that motivation to get back in here and make, try and make another one can be.
Yeah. And the more time you put on it, the harder the feeling of the flop, it sinks into your heart. Like if you spend, for me, the projects that I do take 3, 4, 5 days at a time to make the product, then edit it, do a voiceover, whatever it is. And those flop and you're like, man, and it's discouraging. It feels like crap and it's rough, but you mentioned something really, really important. And I want to kind of jump back into that where you said the first year, you know, your friends and your family, they're buying your products. They're supporting you. They're liking everything that you post. They see that you have this new craft or hobby or whatever in your life, and they want to support you. What I've noticed, and I think that this is something you noticed, after that first year is gone, your family and your friends are gone too. They're like, okay, dude, I can see a wallet so many times, or they're done supporting you financially. And I think it's really important for new crafters and new whatever it is, if you're a woodworker, if you're whatever craft you're into, it's really important to capitalize on that first year with your family. Like sell everything you can to those people, you know, like make your bags in that way, but also realize that that's not sustainable. Your family isn't going to buy everything. So really do your best to harbor a fan base within that time. Like really, really push into the people that aren't your friends and family and build relationships with those people in that time, because it's either sink or swim after the first year.
100%. Like, you know, your buddies can only buy so many belts or wallets from you. And a lot of the time, when I create a new design, I give them one to try and tell me how it is. So now they don't have to buy one. So
it's so true. Like that's how I think about that all the time, because I work with different influencers, or I work with, like you said, family people. And there's my wife's cousin. I love her to death, and she does so much to like represent my company. But like, and everything that I do, I prototype it through her, because she's like, she's a firecracker. She'll tell me where things don't work, and I need that. Like I have to have that. So every time I'm like prototyping something, Michelle will be like, oh yeah, give it to my cousin. Like she'll let you know what it is. And I'm like, dude, she's like one, my biggest supporter, and she owns more of my products than I do at this point. Like things that I never even release that I hope in like 10 years are like collector's items, and she can put her kids through college with them. That might sound a little cocky, but that's what I really hope. Like crazy.
That's the thing. Like I've done clothing too. I did hats, and you know, I've got some shirts and hoodies and stuff. And like, sure, people have bought them, but for the most part, it's family and friends. And you all show up to like the same hockey tournament or something. You look like a bunch of idiots with the same shirt on.
That's also something, because her cousin was over the other night, and I'm prototyping some sandals, and like we were talking about it, and I got a tracing from her because she wears those kind of sandals. But we were talking about t-shirts and like merchandise for a company, and I told her, and I learned this from tattooing, like if you break even on a tattoo, or not a tattoo, if you break even on a t-shirt or apparel in general, and you're not an apparel company, that's good. Like if you spend, let's just say for easy math, you spend $400 on getting like a small t-shirt run done, and you sell half of those, and you make that $400, but all of those other t-shirts go out into the world, that's good. Don't ever think that you're going to make money off of your t-shirts when you're not a t-shirt company.
Yeah. But what I did, my first clothing thing with family and friends, I did a pre-order and figured it out that, okay, with the money I make on this, after we donate and whatever, I could buy an extra, well, I don't know what it was, 30 shirts, so that everything's paid for. And here's another 30 shirts that I could, you know, that one day I'll get them out of the basement.
Yeah, it's shirts are tricky, especially when, like I said, you're not a shirt company. Every time that I do shirts, I only do the bare minimum run, and every time that I've done a shirt, they sell out in the first day because I hype it up. Like, hey, there's only X amount in this size, this size, this size. You have to get them because the last two times that they sold out. And people, like, it's all about how you word things. I'm not a t-shirt company. I make t-shirts that I want to wear. And I can't just buy one. So I'll buy just enough to be able to get a minimum order. And then, you know, give them to friends and family. But it's always the same friends and family that have the same shirt. And I'm like, it's the same thing. Like, I don't know. Except the cool thing is I always send one to my grandpa. And he's an old grizzled man. He's actually going to be on the podcast here soon. And it's so cool. One of the shirts says, like, it's my logo on the front. And then on the back, it says somewhere between Jay-Z and Johnny Cash. And that's always been kind of like my headspace as an artist. Like, I like both of them, whatever. But he wears it around his town, and like all of his old friends are like, somewhere between Jay-Z and Johnny Cash, or younger people will be like, oh, your shirt's so cool. Like, I love that. Like that. And I'm like, yeah, my grandpa's rad.
And people are talking about the brand now too. Say it's working.
You don't get sales off of it. I guarantee, like, no one from his small town was like, oh, that shirt, what is it? Oh, my grandpa doesn't even know how to use a website. So doubt that he, like, I don't know. I haven't sold anything because of it, but my grandpa looks cool, and that's what matters to me.
Totally.
Yeah, that it's so crazy. It's I don't know. I wanted to touch on one thing, though, that you were saying, too, is, like, the expectations that we set for ourselves, putting ourselves there out there on the internet, and how hard that can be on ourselves at sometimes. Do you experience that?
Yeah. I mean, in the beginning, when I first started doing video or like being more active on like Instagram lives or whatever, and, you know, I felt like the way I view brands, like I said, is, you know, I like to know the people and the whole full package. So I should be an open book as well with that, to an extent, obviously, right? So the first time when I did my first YouTube video and talked about my whole story and everything, I don't want to say nerve-wracking, but it's like, okay, this is going on the net. Like, this is, you know, someone around the world might watch this. So, but it's there was a bit of a nerve-wracking too, but now that it's, I think it's cool. I mean, I think, not talking about myself too much, but I think I have a unique story a little bit with it. And I think I want to share it because I think if it can help somebody in some way, by going through something and trying to get put a positive twist on it in the end, it's there's always something more you can do, right?
I think that's awesome. And I think when you don't present yourself as always, like, as a brand, you're not presenting yourself as always sell, but also like, hey, like, if I can help you out, or hey, this is me, this is my story, this is how things came to be, it puts a positive spin on things. And once you kind of forget about numbers so much, it almost naturally just happens. And it always happens when you're not expecting it. Like you said, that video that blew up, we always have the intent on something going viral, air quotes, but it's always when we're just like, oh, we'll just throw this out there. Those are the ones that end up like taking off.
Totally. This one, it like my YouTube video took us 10 hours to film. And then I don't know how long it took him to edit it. And I think it's been viewed like 340 times. My Instagram reel, which took me, I think it's 11 seconds, has 540,000 views.
It's crazy. It's crazy how that goes. And like when I make short form videos that I use, like I multi-purpose it for TikTok and Instagram, and I'll just throw it on like the leather groups on Facebook and whatever. I don't even like put much interest in that side of things. But when I make those, it's the ones that I spend the 4 days that are the most detailed that I'm like, dude, I want to get like the best reaction out of this. Those ones flop. It's the ones that are super simple, that are short, that you don't even think are going to be rad, are the ones that people, and who knows how that works. Like,
it might've just happened organically. Right. And that's sometimes what people are looking for.
Yeah, maybe you posted it at the time where the first 20 people that saw it really liked it, and then it spreads and spreads and spreads, and then it's just wild when it comes to that. But I think that there is a unnecessary pressure that we put on ourselves as makers, because we're supposed to be makers first, and yet we're constantly comparing ourselves to others. And what have been some of your strategies to try to get out of that mindset where you're not looking at the likes that you get on a post compared to one of your peers? Is there anything that you've been able to do to help you get over, or not necessarily get over it, but make it not bother you?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it sort of did, I mean, one is, you know, social media, the IG algorithm is God knows what it is, but it's trying not in the beginning. Sure. Maybe I did it a little bit, but what I've learned now is I've really tried to just enjoy the growth of it, and like the natural growth of something. And like, you know, it's easy when you look back at your first wall and it's like, oh, that's a piece of crap, and get mad at something. You look back and when you got really pissed off when you screwed something up, but that was all part of the journey. And it just kind of just reminding myself to just enjoy, like, you know, cheesy sounding, but like, you know, riding the wave of this and being able to not be jealous of someone else's views or likes, but like inspire me to do a little bit more or try harder, or, and also just being myself. That's part of what I really want to do is my brand, my stuff is just be me. Right. And 'cause I have the benefit, this is my side hustle. So, you know, when I blew up on followers, it was awesome. I was like, oh, this is really cool. Right. But it's not my main source of providing for my family. So it's fun. It's more of a fun thing for me. So I try to just, you know, bury that, more community over competition, and just, you know, appreciate, oh, good for that person. You know, that person blew up. Awesome. I'm proud of them, because we've got to know each other as well too. Right.
Yeah. Maybe I phrased that wrong, because I look at people that have wild success, and you hearing that you had a video that did really well, my inside doesn't go, fuck that dude. It goes, that's awesome. Like, I'm stoked for Justin. He deserves it. Like, and I have the purest heart when it comes to that. I think the other side of things isn't so much comparing myself to two people like yourself that had this awesome thing happen. But when I pour my heart into something, then I post it, and this mostly happens with photos now on Instagram, less with videos, but because Instagram is no longer a photo sharing app, it's a video sharing app. So,
which I miss, by the way, I miss the photos. They're easier.
Even scrolling through Instagram, it's harder with all the reels, and you're like, what? Yeah, it's frustrating. But I post something and I'm like, I've got almost 6,000 followers, and I post something and it gets 45, 50, 60 likes. And I'm like, those numbers don't add up. Like, what? And it's not so much like I want to compare myself to Justin. It's more like, did I do something wrong? Are my followers not, like, am I bumming them out? Like, am I overselling my products? Am I underselling? Like, am I not telling a narrative? Like, am I not, should I be doing more behind the scenes stuff? Like, what am I not doing that I was doing before when I saw these numbers? And then the numbers go up and I'm like, and then I keep doing that and the numbers drop. And it's like, it gets really, really, it can get frustrating. I think for new crafters, whatever you're into, it can be really like, it can really like be negative on your self-esteem.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. There's times where it's, you know, you can beat yourself up pretty easily in this, but I like yourself mentioned, I've been doing a lot of reading of books myself in the past couple of years. I never, you know, 36 years, I read zero books because that wasn't my thing. In the past 2 years, I read like 30 books because it's another sort of therapeutic thing I found for myself. And a lot of those books I read are sort of like self-improvement, you know, business books as well. And a lot of it is just, you know, if I do a post and it doesn't take off or whatever, learn from it. And also, there's a lot of things I have no control over, right? I have no control over the algorithm. I have no control over what happens to it. So I put it out there, and maybe, you know, I put out a really nice edited photo that gets 20 likes and I put out a piece of crap and it gets 100. I try and look at more of the detail of, okay, what time of day, what day of week did I do that? Maybe that's a more popular day to post. So I try that and just try to learn versus getting down on yourself and, you know, pissing yourself off.
I think that you should be a motivational speaker because you're like one of the most optimistic people that I've ever spoken to. And I love it. Like, I try to present myself that way, but I'm also a human being. Like, and I try to bring that like human side to this podcast that like people that maybe have a small following, they're just getting into the craft. They have 200, it doesn't matter the number. They're like, man, why is this dude complaining that his video or his whatever, his photo is only getting X amount of views or whatever. Like, I wish I could be there one day. You never achieve that like expectation. We can look at you. We can look at the guy that has more followers, more. Everyone wants to have this like bigger following, but what is that like? What is that actually? What's the results of that? And what's like the end goal of that? And that's the, I don't have the answer to that question. I don't think any of us do, but I don't know. It's just a strange thing that we're always constantly trying to achieve this obtainable goal. And I wonder where that's come from.
Well, I don't know if in this game of, you know, like in my, I've only been pushing social media the past year and a half or so since I've started this, which coincides with the pandemic where most people are at home. So, you know, we're not socializing with people. We're not doing anything. So it's, I don't know if that's a way that we use like a, people have just sort of just found that avenue to connect with more people. And the more people we think we are following us or liking our stuff, we think we're just kind of more, oh, we're not sitting at home alone doing nothing. You know what I mean? Well, we really are, but it's maybe that's just sort of an aspect of how the pandemic has impacted that as well, right?
Yeah. Well, not everything that came from the pandemic is necessarily bad. I mean, I started a business because of it, and I've made some of the best friends that I've ever had in my entire life and really dug deep into a community that, like you said, I probably wouldn't have if I had the same accessibility or if I never, like, if I didn't get, you know, laid off from my previous job, I'd still be doing that job. I know I would. Like, I wouldn't have bought a cheap leather kit off of Amazon to help with my mental health in like the downtime had the pandemic never hit. And of course, there's so many people, I don't want to go into the details. There's a lot of bad that came from it for a lot of people. And that's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm saying is that going back to your optimistic mindset, I'm trying to plug into that, is that it's not so bad. Like, I'm sitting in a leather studio that we built that I never thought that I would have. And I'm so grateful and like fortunate because of it. It's awesome.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, like from this, you know, I have a friend in California. I got a friend in Scotland now. I got a buddy I talked to in Australia. We're usually, you know, outside my 1 hour radius of where I live. I didn't know anybody or talk to anybody.
I think that that's the cool thing is that within this community, you can almost put out like a call. If you're active and you really put time into the community, you could put out a call like, hey, I'm in this state or this area. Like, anyone around? Anyone want to hang out? Like, hey, I'm going to be stopping by. I'll be in town for a week or two. Like, anyone want to get lunch? Like, I've been out in Atlanta and spent time with friends that are in the leather community. Like, I say this to everyone that's a guest, like on the podcast, and I mean it with my whole heart. Like, if you're in Southern California, you and your family have a guest room. We're going to barbecue. We're going to have a pool party. We're going to hang and hopefully make some products and some content together. And like that extends to you. And that extends to like my really close knit within this community. And that wouldn't have happened had I not gotten into this community. I'm a better person because of Leathercraft, for sure, way better person.
Same goes to you, man. Come up here. I mean, it's cold. It's it sucks, but welcome anytime.
I can do cold way better than I can do hot, man. Like, once I'm naked and the cops are on the way, you can't get much more naked, you know? Like, I can put another jacket.
I don't mind cold. I'm same thing. I've always said the same thing. I can bundle up. I can get warm. I can't get, there's times you can't get cool enough. It's just...
Right. Once you're a sex offender, you're a sex offender forever, man. That's too
going,
much.
I want to ask you, going back when you said you bought your first Amazon kit after tattooing, what drew you to do that? What was like, okay, I'm going to try and make something out of leather. Like, why did that?
That's a great question. Thank you. Thank you for asking. So prior to even the pandemic being the pandemic, I struggle with anxiety really bad. And something I found that helped me was watching YouTube videos that specifically showed a start and a finish of a project. So I would watch like wood turning. I still love wood turning videos.
Amazing. It's amazing.
Where they're just like scraping wood. And I'm like, dude, that is so cool. Like, I just think that it's like, the time lapse of it is so intriguing to me. That and watching like people make pottery.
I love pottery videos.
Like, yeah. Or like people building a cabin out in the woods where there's no one around. Like that kind of like progression where you can see a start and finish point. For me, when I was laying in bed and I couldn't even get out because I was depressed, like it changed the chemistry in my brain a little bit to release a little dopamine, even though I wasn't the one that was doing the project. I could still appreciate it enough to be like, man, it gave me hope that one day that I would be able to achieve something. And so I was watching a lot of those and a lot of leathercraft videos. So two people really come to mind when it comes to that. And it's probably the gateway for a lot of people, Parker from Stock and Barrel and Ryan from Little King Goods. And I would watch their videos and I'd always had hopes of making YouTube videos, but I wanted to do like traveling, like foodie videos, which whatever, not going to happen, or may happen later in life. But I started watching their videos, and one thing that stood out to me, and I've talked to Parker about this, is not just the projects that he was doing or even the start to finish things, but how he presented himself as a family man and seeing his studio and seeing the growth of his business and his craft and everything, the behind the scenes stuff, really inspired me. So the pandemic hit and I was in a bad place mentally. Like I was working from home and I'm not good at that. Like I did sales and I'm more of like an in-person go to the place, talk and like negotiate and all of these things, like calling somebody on the phone. I just hated it. So I knew that was going to go downhill. I was struggling really bad with drinking and drugs at the time, and I needed to get myself into a better place. And so I remember like, man, I had already done the gardening like everyone else did. I planted a garden. I started doing like slow cooks on the barbecue, like smoking food and trying to spend my day, like the whole day doing something. And I got boredom in that. So I remember I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to get into some kind of craft, some kind of art hobby thing, whatever. And I started researching it. And the lowest cost of entry was leathercraft. So I just got a $50, $60, $70 leathercraft kit off of Amazon. And it showed up and it sat in my room for, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks. And one day I was just like, okay, well, I'm going to at least open this up. Then I just used the tools that I could and I put together a really junky wallet like we all do. And I thought it was so cool. And I was very braggadocious about it. And not braggadocious, but like, I was really excited to show people like, hey, at least I got like a little card wallet. And at the time I had like, I listened to a lot of like comedy podcasts and the ads on comedy podcasts, like the Theo Vaughn's and the Chris D'Elia and all of those kind of podcasts, all of the ads kind of come in cycles. So there's companies that come in that sponsor all of them. And at the time it was Ridge Wallet. And I thought that would be like, I wanted to get one of those. They're way too expensive for what they were. So I got a cheap Amazon one. I turned into like a front pocket carry guy and I loved it. And so I was like, man, I can make something like this out of leather. And so I just made a small card holder and just kept on going. And then I realized I loved it. And then I got blasted out of my face and I was hammered drunk and don't remember the first 2 months of even doing leathercraft. And I got sober and I was scared to death that once I had detox and I was getting through the initial first stages of sobriety, that I wouldn't be able to sit back down at my bench because I correlated it with drinking and drugs. I thought it would be a trigger and it would lead me to want to drink. So I set a goal of like, all right, I'm going to sit down for an hour and step away and see how I feel. And I still would reach for where I kept my drink at all times and slowly started like going 2 hours, not reaching for it, and then 3 hours and 4 hours. And then my whole life changed. I was able to slow down enough to get good at leathercraft. And it happened really rapidly. I ended up deciding I was going to name my brand. And then I got Maker's Marks and I started selling products and it snowballed really quickly. It
snowballs real fast.
It does. If you get your mind right and you really put what's necessary into it. And I remember I was working at the time and I would come home after work and put another 8 hours in and like, cause I loved it. It was a release to me.
Oh, that's so cool.
That's a long answer to a short question, brother.
Well, it sounds like coming from doing tattooing, you need a creative outlet for you as well, right? You need that.
Yeah.
Which I dabbled with too. And I was similar. I always wanted to do something. And I was like, I started making stuff out of wood, which is wildly messy. And, you know tools. I have a one car garage. Where am I going to put all this crap? And then, yeah, it was the same. I just start somewhere. And then before you know it, that $70-$80 starter set is
thousands and thousands of dollars. And it never ends. I talk to people that have been doing leather craft for forever. Even a guest that we're going to have on shortly, he does axe restoration. He's been doing it a long time and he's really at the top of his game and really good dude. Real bright personality, we'll just say. And he says, he's got so many tools and he's like, I'll never stop getting tools. That means that you stopped like investing in yourself. There's always something that you can do or design your own tools. And like, there's so much of that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's crazy. At the beginning, I had no interest in doing tattoo imagery on leather. I was trying to design a brand that was going to be marketed and geared towards like high-end either athletes or I don't know what it would be like the expensive people that want to spend money on a really good product. Like I was really focused on marketing my stuff towards that. And then I just started transferring tattoo images onto my leather products. And that's where things really changed overnight. Now, if I post something that isn't like tooled and painted, I almost feel like people are like, don't waste our time. Like, show us something cool. Don't just show us something like this isn't what we came here for, you know? And it's hard because those simple projects are what I like. Like everything that I make for myself is not flashy. It's just built really well. Like I put a lot of emphasis on that. And I don't know, man, it's crazy like that.
That's cool that you'd be able to like bring what you did into what you do and and kind of starting in within your community, which is something I got told as a tip as well, is like one is trying to grow your brand, start like locally, wickedly locally with the markets, with the local papers, whatever it might be. And then also being, I have a full-time day job, is trying to stay in that. And my full-time day job is actually, there's a lot of relatable products. I'm in the cigar business. So I distribute cigars across Canada to all the stores.
Distribute a lot some of cigars to me, big dog.
California, man, that's an expensive state. but there's a lot of leather, like leather cigar cases, leather cigar holders, pipe holders. So part of which we'll get into is the part of the sewing machine was to try and get into that, because hand stitching, a lot of that stuff is, you know, I do this on the side, so I don't have that much time. So if I hand stitch a cigar case and it takes me 3 days, you know, how do you price that? You know what I mean? It's...
It's really hard. And I think that's a really good intro into what we're going to discuss next, which is hand stitching versus machine stitching, and the stigma of each one of those, and how when it's the right time for each. Because, you know, you mentioned while we were talking before that you had just gotten a sewing machine, and for me, I want to get a sewing machine, but I also sell my products at such a high price point that I can justify hand stitching, and I like it, but I also want to start a more economical like line of my products that are the same, just more economical. And I think there's a time and place for each of them, but what made you decide to, I mean, you kind of just explained it, but what really made you pull the trigger from going from hand stitching to buying a sewing machine?
Well, I made a bag for my sister, kind of like a mini tote side bag thing. It was my first attempt at a bag, and it turned out pretty cool. And I posted it. I had a lot of interest on it, but this hand stitching this tote with the rolled edges and everything, it took like a long time. So again, it's like, how do I price something like that? People, you know, is someone going to spend $200, $300, $400, $500 on this freaking thing? No, right? But then also, being a side business, if I get an hour a night to sneak out here and do some work, I'm lucky. So that one bag, that's going to take me 2 weeks. So again, the machine will be able to allow me to do the bigger projects, and I'm still going to hand stitch all my wallets, stuff like that. I'm still going to hand stitch, but I had a lot of requests for things like from carpenters for workshop aprons, log carriers, stuff like that. And, you know, I'm not hand stitching a rolled edge on an apron. It's not going to happen. So I wanted to make sure I had enough interest in those types of products to justify putting the money into the machine. And I think there's benefits of both ways. Like you said, having the economical option to your products. Like I know a lot of brands have that, you know, when you buy a wallet, you can select the hand versus the machine stitch, and, you know, they both have their benefit, cost versus durability and all those sorts of things. But it took me a while to finally pull the trigger on it, but that was the driving force, is to make sure I had products I wanted to make and interest in it to justify it.
Well, they're not cheap. That's probably one of the biggest investments that you'll make until you get into like hydraulic, like clicker presses and stuff like that. But even like a hydraulic clicker press is about the same price almost as a really, really good sewing machine, which we need like an industrial sewing machine. And, you know, I'm a part of multiple different like community groups within Leathercraft, and there's one in particular that stemmed from the Clubhouse app, which I talk about often. And there's times that, you know, we speak, by we I mean them, because I don't have any experience with sewing machines, and I hear the conversations and kind of watch what is said along those topics and those conversations, and it gives me anxiety, like the maintenance of a good sewing machine and like the learning curve of it and how to, like, I'm horrible with terms, especially within Leathercraft, like it to know what to buy and how to repair a sewing machine, it scares me. And I know the only way to be able to scale is to eventually get a sewing machine. And I set time goals for my business. And next year, that's the next thing that I'm going to get, is a sewing machine, so I can offer this more economical line of my products. But man, I couldn't agree with you more. There's times that I'm sewing like those sandals that I'm making, or a belt. It's like hand stitching a belt takes forever. And your hand, like I use 1.2 or 1.5 Reese Tiger thread, and that stuff is like barbed wire, man. Like I have calluses that are so crazy on my fingers. My hands hurt after a whole day of doing it. Everything in my body's cramped up, and I get it. Not to mention like just wrangling all of that thread when you're hand stitching. It can be frustrating at times.
It's catching on everything. You're standing across the room. It's,
yeah. I know on a live that you posted not too long ago, you were talking about like how thread will get snagged on, you know, the different knobs and everything like that, and how tilting the head closer to you makes a big difference. And it's so true. There's times that it gets frustrating, or if you're punching your holes into your leather, sometimes it you can get all the way to the end of a project. And mind you, it takes me 3, 4, 5 days to get to the end part where I'm putting everything together, and your stitch is just out of line, a slight of a millimeter, and you're like, oh my God, it's so frustrating at times.
As much as I say enjoy the process and ride the wave of learning, I can get fired up in here sometimes when I screw that last punch is on an angle. It's like,
yeah. And it's, I think at this point, like at least for me, I know it's the same thing. Like people spend a lot of money. You can't like to redo 5 days of work for someone, that's a lot of money out of my pocket, because I got to push everything a week away. You know what I mean? To redo a project. And I don't put anything out that like I'm not proud of. I don't care if it's the last second of work. Like I'll start the whole, I've gotten really good at like fixing things, but a miss like stitch line, there's no way to fix that.
I should bring us back to the whole sewing machine thing too. I got this sewing machine and I watch all the videos. I think I'm ready to go. And it comes pretty much assembled. So I had this vision in my head. It's going to get here day or two. I'm going to be humming stuff through there. Not even close. It's been like 3 weeks. I had never touched a sewing machine until this thing got delivered. And it's just, there's a lot to learn.
I got one of those cheap Chinese like shoe patcher machines. My grandpa bought one of me. Dude, I wanted to just whip that thing into traffic after day two. Like I built a whole stand for it. Like I'm trying to watch every video that I can watch on it. And it's just jammed. The whole thing doesn't work. Like I'd already done all of the like stuff to like smooth the edges. You know how it comes like real rigid. Everything is just, if you touch anything, you're going to get like cut. So I'm filing everything, trying to make it the best I can. And now it's a big, huge paperweight. And that made me even more nervous about getting it makes me nervous about getting a sewing machine. And like, not just now, but like in the future when I'm ready, like I almost rather just hire someone to be like, somebody that sews for me, because I'm like, I just don't want to do it. Like, and if I don't want to do it, it's going to make it so much harder to do. Like I love hand stitching I love it because I can also bitch about it too. And I love bitching about things. So it's true, man. Totally true. Do you think that there's a stigma around the terms of handmade and when you start using sewing machines? Or I know for me, I thought handmade was everything's handmade, no machines. Now where I'm at in my career and where you're at in your career with leathercraft, we're still using our hands at every aspect. I think the term handmade still applies to people that are using sewing machines. I think anyone that is making their products in their garage with whatever means it takes to make it get done, it's still handmade. Your hands on the product the entire time.
Yep. Yeah. No, I think I was similar in the beginning. It's like, oh, there's a machine. I didn't even want a power sander, because I was like, nothing electric. I want to be able to do this in the forest if I had to. But as you learn and you grow, and as I'm learning now, it's, you know, wallets and belts and smaller things are awesome. But to scale up, I don't want to miss out on an opportunity. I don't want someone to come to me and say, hey, my carpentry company needs 15 leather shop aprons, and you know, we'll pay this much. You know, I want to be able to say, yeah, I can do that, versus, you know, it just broadens what you can do. And at some point to grow, I feel like you need to, maybe not. I mean, maybe you've got that.
I at this point, because I think anytime there's the excitement of when you first get into leathercraft and you're like, oh, it is handmade, and everything we're doing, like there's an excitement about making something with your hands, and you want to be a purist and you're like, oh man, this is so cool. And then you start marketing your products as handmade and you're like, I don't want to go back on that. Like, I don't want to say that it isn't handmade. And so you start like psychoanalyzing every tool that you use. And I'm like, at least I didn't. It sounds like it was the same thing for you. And you want to, I don't know how to explain. I guess you start thinking like, man, what are other people going to think? Like if I say this is handmade and I use a sewing machine, is someone going to call me out on that? Am I lying? Like at least that's the way I think. Then in the last few months, I've just been, I don't care. I don't really care what, like, as much as I love you, Justin, if you were to be like, hey man, that's not really handmade because you're using a sewing machine, I'd be like, go fuck yourself. I don't care. Like, I don't care what you think because one, how many products, and I'm only using you because you're right in front of me, but like how many products are our peers buying from us? I probably sold 3 or 4 or 5 things to, our peer group, leather crafters, leathersmiths, whatever. The majority of our products are sold to people that don't give a crap if we're using a sewing machine or if we're hand stitching things. It's personal preference at this point. It's so true, man. And yeah, I think that's a good point too. Like we're not sending our products in a robot putting it together. And I know that there'll be a time that a guest is on and we're talking about like laser cutters and, you know, all that whole process of doing things and how do you market that then? I think that at that point, I'm going to still have the same attitude that I do now in the sense of, I don't care. I don't care like what kind of terms you put on things because I don't buy, well, I take that back. I buy things from other makers because I want to support them. It's not that I can't, it's because I like them. You know what I mean? Like I'm buying things because I enjoy the person. So, but I think it's interesting how our mindset changes through the different chapters of our maker career. I think it's really strange and it's cool. And I think it's similar. Like we all kind of go through those different phases.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's part of growing, right? I mean, yeah, I go, like you said, getting stuff from other makers. I've always been a support local guy. It's always in my town. It's a small town and it's very outdoorsy, crafty, kind of hippie community. It's awesome. It's a great town. And there's a lot of that opportunity to support those local kind of businesses, which I've always done. So I still to this day, like I'm carrying a wallet from Alex from Lighthouse Leather right now.
That guy rips. I love his stuff.
He's awesome.
That's cool. I think that's super important, man. I think it's good to support each other when we can, especially if you live in a small community. I think it's, you mentioned something a little further back within our conversation about how you were given advice about starting really local, like doing local events, then kind of growing and expanding from there. I totally feel, and I'm not saying this is the right way, it's probably the wrong way. I did it completely opposite. Like I've never done a market or an event or anything like that. Like I think because of the work that I do is so customizable and it's so time, it just takes a long time to make something for me. And so to put together 20, 30, 40 products to go set up a booth at a farmer's market or at an event here, that would take me, you know, 6 months to be able to do. And then I also don't know if that crowd even likes that kind of stuff. We live next to Norco, which is like so strange. It's like going to the very center of middle America. Like there's horses right walking down the street, but we're in like Southern California. Like it's such a weird town. And anyone that's from Southern California that knows of Norco would totally know what I'm talking about. Like it's so shocking. And you like, I don't think that those people that are like really like conservative and really like rodeo and horses and all of that kind of stuff is going to like really be interested in like, you know, a Heart and Dagger or a traditional rose or like a scorpion or, you know, like the traditional stuff. So I don't even know where I would sell. Like I just sell off my website and through Instagram and TikTok and
saddles, man.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I would love to do a market, and I would, the way I would like to do it is getting a group of, you know, leathersmiths, yourself included, and doing something that's kind of centered to everyone and put on like an event type of thing where people know what they're coming for. And we bring all of our audience to that place, and, you know, we sell our products that way for two reasons. Cause I just want to hang out with my friends in person. Totally. And that's really it. Like if I sell enough products to pay for the trip or whatever, that would make it worth it to me.
Business trip, right?
Yeah. Business trip. Air quote. That's cool. Yeah, man, I want to hear, I mean, we were just talking about events and how you've started there. You have some upcoming events and markets and stuff like that. Can we hear about, there's two things, what the events are, but first, how do you prep for that? Like what does that look like to you? And you're speaking to someone that doesn't know anything about it. So I'm genuinely interested in your immediate audience right here.
So I did my first market. I've done four now, I think. Four. Yeah. So again, coming from my smallish town I live in, being very outdoorsy, crafty kind of community. There's a lot of them that go on. So that was beneficial. But it was one of those things where I'd ask people, like, just go for it. Like, just, you don't know until you try, right? And you learn from your experiences. So my first market, buy a tent, you know, get some tables, I got some flags made. I spent God knows how many hours making like wallets and valet trays. And I had ordered my shirts and my hats and everything in time. I built a ton of belts to learn that at a market, people pretty much just want to spend like 30, 40 bucks. So valet trays, keychains, awesome. I mean, I did in our business, it's, you know, it's one thing to see a wallet on social media, but then to actually get to touch the wallet and meet the person is another thing.
It changes everything.
So I did get a lot of like follow-up sales from that. Like people like, oh, this is awesome. You know, my husband would love this. Let me, I'll take your car and I'll show him. And I did see that benefit. For my first market, I still have a lot of the wallets I've made. In the meantime, I've switched my stitching whole style and thread. So I must have 40 wallets that are off brand now for me. So, I mean, preparing for those things, it's easy to just spend money and go nuts. But I recently just had someone reach out about how to prepare for their first market. And I kind of the same thing. It's, you know, people go to the market, you know, they're not looking to spend 140 bucks on a field note holder or something, really, you know? So it's, it is fun. And I've done some Christmas markets at breweries, which is a totally different thing. But for me, being, you know, a family guy, I'd like to do them where my family can come. So when I did the local ones, we were like outdoor in a park, like along a river. So like my wife and daughter, my dog can be there and stuff too. So that's kind of the stuff I'd rather do. If it's a Saturday, you know, I'm working Monday to Friday. If this is a Saturday thing, that's a day away from another day away from my family. So if I can incorporate the two together, that's what I'm going to do. But I know. I mean, they're fun. I do have some coming up. I think here in my town, we do, I can't remember the name, I'm drawing a blank. It's like an art in the park, but it's in the city, and it's all these different like artists and all forms of it, but there's a market portion of it. I'm gonna get a setup on that. But now that I've learned is just, you know, what types of products people are looking for.
I think that's my takeaway from it, because I wouldn't have even thought that, but it seems so common sense now. When I go to a market, I'm not like, oh, I'm peeling off, you know, $100, $150, $200 for something. Like, that's not where your mindset is. So I think that the people that are listening, that are potentially going to start getting in to doing markets and events like this, knowing to have a low price point product where people can pick up for $20, $30, $50, and then hopefully that transitions into a bigger purchase down the road. But it all goes back to what we were talking about before. Like, people want to support you, and that might look like supporting you with $10, $20, $50, not the $200 item that you have. So knowing to stock up on those products to bring, and then having a small handful of the higher price products that you can sell to that one person that has money that they can spend. And that's the key takeaway that I get from what you just described. It makes perfect sense now, but knowing me, I would have been like, oh, I want to bring this portrait of Kurt Cobain. Like, there's someone that's going to like that. Like, maybe not though. Like,
you have a very unique thing, which it might, you know, that is more of like my wallet, you know, as unique as they might be, you could still find them something similar-ish. You're not really going to find a hand-tooled Kurt Cobain wallet really anywhere else.
I think but you're right. And I think that I'm very fortunate, and I never let a day pass go that I don't realize how fortunate that I've been able to cross over my previous art skills into what I'm doing now. Like, I it didn't come easy. People are always, oh man, I wish I could do that. I'm like, spend 25 years making art, and then, you know, it's not like my job is to make it look easy, but it's not easy, and it's very, very time consuming, and it's a lot of unseen hours that people don't see. But that's the thing too, is because there's such a limited amount of people, if any, that are doing the portrait style stuff, or the American traditional folk art type stuff, because there's so many, that there's not many people that are doing it. People kind of seek me out to do it, where I don't have to deliver. Like, I really try to even stray away at this point on making like custom projects, meaning like things outside my catalog. My custom version of things is, you know, you, Justin, reaching out and be like, hey man, I really want like a, I don't know, a clipper ship. Yeah. Or my portrait of my dog, or like a traditional clipper ship, or, you know, my wife really likes roses, or I want to get something. Like, I've followed your work, I know. And then I've built a rapport with people at this point that they just tell me what it is that they're looking to get done. And they know I'm going to do the best when they seek me out and give me freedom within their idea. And I spend a lot of time. One thing that I've really transferred over that's different this year from last year is spending a lot of time, or the needed time, to really conversate with my client base, to get on a Zoom call, to at least talk to them on the phone and show them my shop, show them the materials that I'm using. Because like you said, when people touch it, it's so much different, and we can't do that. I'm selling, you know, I'm sending things to New Zealand, Australia, Japan, all of these places. It's not going to happen. Like, and so it at this point, I feel like the time spent is starting to make sense for the price point that I'm selling my products at. Before, I didn't feel like that at all. I raised my prices this year, which is hard, but it's the best thing that I ever did. Now I can justify that extra 2-3, sometimes 5 hours of conversation back and forth to get it exactly the way that the person wants it.
Yeah, it makes sense.
It matters.
Yeah, totally.
It matters. All of our products are luxury goods. What you're making is a luxury good. Anyone that's listening to this that makes things with their hands, it's a luxury good. If you're a furniture maker and you make it with your hands, that's luxury. People can go to IKEA. People can go to Tilly's and buy a cheap, crappy wallet. Like, our stuff isn't for everyone, and it shouldn't be for everyone.
Totally.
That's the way it goes. So
actually, one other market tip I have to share, because I went through it. Test your point of sale card reader before you get there. I did a Christmas market, got there, didn't work. Being it was near Christmas, couldn't get a hold of them to fix it, had to rely on cash. So test your POS at the time.
Jeez, that's great. Could you not just do like
Well, they can do PayPal and PayPal, whatever, yeah, as well. Yeah.
Not everyone.
But a lot of the market crowd exactly wouldn't have had it. So
it's shocking sometimes that I realize that, like, I don't sell in person much. There's times that, like, a handful of my clients live relatively, like, within an hour of where I'm at, and then they either pay cash or whatever. But I don't have a card reader because I'm not selling things on, but it's either PayPal, Venmo, Cash App.
Yeah.
I've tried to take as much crypto. I was, until it completely took a shit. But, like, I was trying to take even crypto for my products. Like, I'm trying to stay on top of my technology game.
That's a whole other world I want to learn about, but it's
you physically look like a guy that would be a crypto bro.
I'm so on technology. I should be, but I just, like, going back to the whole YouTube Instagram thing, I'm just, and I know this much about Instagram now. I don't know how you make that smaller for YouTube. And it's like, well, it's not going to start all over.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, Justin, I'm super stoked that we had this opportunity. It came at a perfect time. I know we've been trying to do this for a while now, and, you know, life happens, but I feel like this happened at the perfect timing. And I'm stoked that you took time out of your busy life to come on here. I can't thank you enough, because time is money, man. So thanks for spending your time with me, brother.
No, thank you, man. I think this is awesome. What you're doing, this pod, your stuff, everything's awesome. So thanks so much for having me, man.
Yeah, we'll have you back on shortly. But in the meantime, can you plug yourself? Can you tell people where they can find your work? Instagram, YouTube. I'm also going to link that wherever you're either hearing this this podcast or seeing this podcast on YouTube. It'll be clickable, but maybe someone's driving. Where can people find your products?
Yeah, so my website is just royalpeakgoods.com. On Instagram, royal.peak.goods. On Facebook, Royal Peak Goods. YouTube, Royal Peak Goods. But yeah, man, let's keep it all uniform, and thanks so much.
Awesome. Absolutely. Thank you guys for joining us on this week's Wake and Make podcast. If you haven't yet, please subscribe, like this, and share it with at least one of your friends. We're putting a lot of time and effort into this. And if you think somebody else can find value in it, please share it with them. Until next week, we'll see you later. See ya.
Way back a year ago.